You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello there, welcome back. This is a recording with Sarah Millican, which was episode 7, if you can believe such a thing. So we're talking 10 years ago, but at that stage, Sarah was already well off the blocks as a comedian, performing to huge audiences with her unbounded positivity and incredible mindset. Now, as you know, I'm writing a book at the moment about the mindset of comedians and how you can use it, and Sarah is coming up time and time again. We're going to hear in this elderly episode from the Compendium, talking about going into a gig with no baggage, winning round at least half an audience. We're going to talk about not using support, as Sarah did at that time. She has, in fact, just flown to Australia, I believe, with Sally Ann Hayward, fabulous comic, and Sarah's frequent support. And we're also going to get into the values of prep, the values of sleep, all-nighters, pasta in a flask, and why she doesn't have material on bricklayers. So we're going to get into all of those things. Thank you once again for downloading this Compendium. We've got a few more coming your way throughout January as I focus on the book and on one or two other things, including the release of my special I Need You Alive, which is going to be a moment on the platform, Moment, on the 23rd of February at 8 p.m. We can all watch it together. You can even get a ticket for a live Q&A and an after party with me. So I say live, I mean online, but live. I'll be there in person, and I hope you will too. So go to stuartgoldsmith.com to find out more about that. Here is Sarah Millican.
You are very positive. You're really positive.
Yes.
You're really, like, we were talking about Dan Evans's podcast earlier on. We should officially mention here that you are the first person I'm interviewing who's already heard the show.
Hooray!
Hooray!
I win some kind of prize.
Ceremony, definitely. You can be an ultra goldsmith.
Oh, yeah. Yes!
There's only one.
I was just a super, was I a super
You were a super goldsmith before,
super
yeah.
Goldsmith.
Yeah. And that idea would never have probably been mentioned again had you not excitedly gone, yay, I'm a super goldsmith. But now it lives, and it's your fault. So someone, like, in a conversation I had with Dan, as we were saying, whilst being incredibly endearing, has this kind of, not quite a darkness or a sadness necessarily, but he has this kind of cheesed off sort of,
kind of
attitude.
Doer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think when I speak to him, I kind of go, I not just when I speak to him. I mean, I also am someone who can be a bit more kind of, God, this is hard. This comedy life. This is a hard thing. This takes a lot of me and all the rest of it.
Mm.
Whereas you have always, as long as I've known you, been so positive and been a kind of a breath of fresh air in the circuit, but also just one of those people who kind of goes, look how amazing this is.
Well, yeah, but when do you have your sort of more kind of mawkish moments? When are you, is that after a hard gig, or is that after you get in and it's 3 a.m. and you've got to be up at 9 and you've driven all night, or is it after a thing, or is it just sometimes it comes over you?
Yes, that one.
Oh, right, because I had the other kind after a hard gig,
yes.
Or after...
Sensible, understandable,
yeah.
Reactive...
Yeah,
tiredness.
But then I have my rule. You know my rule. Is it time? Should I tell you my rule?
Yeah, go on.
This is Millican's Law.
Okay, love it.
rather arrogantly called it. This is the, if you have a bad gig, you're only allowed to be annoyed at yourself until 11 a.m. the next day. Okay.
I've heard a variation on this, which is wait 24 hours, have a wank, get over it. If anyone remembers telling me that, write in, remind me who you were.
Why do you have to wait 24 hours before you're allowed a wank?
I think you're allowed other wanks
Is that like an Uber wank?
Exactly. That's the okay. That's
with
the final
candles.
Wank. Exactly. It's a posh wank before you posh go back wank. To being happy again. So, okay, so yours is...
24 hours is too long. If you've got a gig the next day, that 24 hours is too long. So mine, and I made this up, and I made this up to help get me over bad gigs, and it absolutely 100% works. So 11 o'clock the next day, you have to draw a line under it and get over it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not allowed to, you sort of, until then, you're allowed to be annoyed at yourself or annoyed at the gig or annoyed at the promoter or annoyed at the audience or just frustrated, all of those horrible things that come with a bad gig. So 11 o'clock, you have to get rid of it. Equally, if you have a brilliant gig, you have to get rid of it at 11 o'clock as well.
Oh, very good.
So you can't be smug and think you're like king of the world after 11 o'clock. Because if you go into your next gig, which could very easily be the next day, either thinking you're brilliant or either thinking that you're terrible, you will die either way. Because you go in all Billy Two Dicks. I think I made that up as well. So, used to be Charlie Big Potatoes.
It's Charlie Big Potatoes where I'm from, yeah.
I like Billy Two Dicks. You go in all Billy Two Dicks thinking, I'm going to nail this. You'll die because you're not concentrating on the gig. But if you go in thinking, oh, they're all going to hate me, they will because you won't be very good. So you get rid of it all. I have been known to get up earlier than planned so I could have a little bit more morning in.
Okay, so you could either wallow or champion yourself.
Exactly. Cool. And it absolutely 100% works because you have to get rid of whatever it is and you have to treat every individual gig individually. You have to treat them all on their own on their own merits, and you can't go in with baggage. So that's one thing that I've done to get sort of help get through it.
So that sounds to me like you've got what is known in this world as willpower, which I think is something I aspire to. I don't feel like I've got much willpower at all. I've got kind of a relentless drive to somehow do a thing, but that seems calm and positive and right. This is a sensible way of doing it.
But if it's a rule?
Yeah. But you still decided to make it a rule, haven't you?
Yeah, but as soon as you tell other people that it's a rule, and other people, like, I know a couple of comics who told me that they had told new comics coming up about the rule. So if new comics are doing it, I mean, I'd stuck by it anyway, but if new comics are sticking by it, I can't not.
Yeah, good. That's good.
And also, nobody would ever know, I would know. Uh-huh. And it's just really healthy. I think it's really healthy to just go, it's the same as, if any bad thing happens at work or anything, I think you can quite easily go, okay, we're just going to let it go now. Because it's not healthy. It's not healthy for you. It doesn't make you a good comic if you're hanging around. And it makes you lose self-confidence. And there are enough things in this industry to make you lose self-confidence without one bad gig doing the job for you.
To hear you say, when you've had a bad gig, when I've had a bad gig like this, do you still have bad gigs?
Yeah, yeah.
You're Sarah Millican off of the telly.
Off of the telly. It's different. It's not the same kind of bad. It's hard, I'd say, rather than bad. But sometimes on a tour show, they take a bit of getting going.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, because they've paid to see me, it's not like at a comedy gig where you have to get them, grab them in the first sort of couple of minutes because you're one of a number of comics and they don't know anything about you generally. So these people on tour have paid to see me, but I always work out there are probably half of them are like proper fans who have seen me on the telly or have seen me do live stuff before and just like what I do, and half of them have been brought.
Yes.
So that balances out at a sort of generally lukewarm audience, because there are some people who I could say hello and they'd go, oh! And then other people would go, oh, I don't know if I'm going to like this.
Yeah.
So you have to win half of the audience.
And it can work against you, can't it? If some people over enjoy themselves. I saw Eddie Izzard in London in the West End, and he walked down stage and went, hello. And people fell about actually laughing. And that made me, as a huge lifelong fan of Eddie Izzard, that made me kind of go, oh, well, let him do some stuff.
Yeah, but it's adorable. It's usually because people have sometimes bought tickets like a year in advance, and they're just fizzing.
Sure. No, I wouldn't be negative about those people, but in terms of the balance of the room,
it can sometimes mess up the sort of timing if people laugh at different points and things. But generally, I have a lovely time. I'm very lucky. I have a lovely time because I do slightly ruder version of what I do on the telly. I'm not massively different. It's ruder and it's more sweary, but it's not in style. It's not any different to what I do on the telly. So I think people hopefully are satisfied. But every now and again, there'll be a harder one. If it's hard in the first half, then I think if I had a support, I never have a support, but if I had a support, that's what they would have done. So I make out like I'm going on new in the second half.
Okay.
I don't go like, hello, and like I've not met them.
No, of course,
but I come
course.
Out thinking, this would be, if I had a support, this would be where they'd be nice now, where a lot of comics actually who have a support come out in the second half when they're already lovely and warm.
Yeah.
So I come out, I can't ever take the baggage from the first half into the second half.
Sure.
So I go into the second half thinking, this is where comics who have a support start. And 9 times out of 10 on the harder ones for the first half, the second half is lovely because they're warm, they've had another drink, and blah, blah, blah. Very rare, but it does happen. It's hard all night. It's not a death. I never die like that. I think I could at a gig still, but not at a show where I'm on the ticket. But it does happen sometimes where it's hard throughout the whole show. But then I still never comment on it. I never do any of those rookie mistakes of saying, oh, that normally gets more, or we are quite quiet tonight, because they don't know that they're not a lively audience. Yep. And sometimes you realise, that's my stomach rumbling, apologies if you picked that up. Sometimes it's because it's Tuesday. Like, I remember I did my second Edinburgh show. I was in the Beside at the Pleasant, and Mickey Flanagan was in before me.
Yeah.
In after me, sorry. And one of the days, he used to just go, how was it? And I'd go, oh, they were lovely. Or, you know, Monday. And I went, oh, they're really tough today. And he went, it's Wednesday. And I went, oh, yes. because all days blend into one in Edinburgh. You forget that. Friday, they'll be a bit more drunk. Saturday, they'll be lovely. Sunday, they'll be quieter. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they might be a little bit more quiet, and then, or a bit more listening, a bit more. So your clever stuff might work a bit better. And then Thursday, back to drinking. Friday, heavy drinking. It still all works as a normal week, but because we're going, what day is it today? It's day 14.
We're
not working on the usual week.
Yeah.
So I do still have, sometimes when I try out new stuff, you know, like you said, you did a gig with a, somebody did, and they're often unlisted, and the reason people are unlisted, and I sometimes go unlisted, I'm not like the person that you were on with last night, but sometimes when you're unlisted it's better because you don't get like an audience full of my fans in who are just going to laugh at everything I say. If I'm trying out new stuff, I want it to be a bit more of a, not discerning is not the wrong way, because that sounds like I'm being really mean about my fans, and I'm not at all, but I want people who are going to go,
people that you have to win.
Yes.
Yeah.
And people who will decide whether it's funny or not. And not saying that my fans don't know the difference, but they just already like me and I need to win
people
over.
Well, it's the difference between my brother coming up and telling me a joke and some guy in the street coming and telling me a joke.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why you don't go listed. But sometimes when you're unlisted, you step out and people will go, oh, or, you know, they hear your name and they get excited. Sure. But then there are definitely other people who go, oh, I hate her.
That's interesting.
Because
yeah,
they've seen you on the telly and they wouldn't have... They might not necessarily have booked to come to this gig if they'd known you were on.
Sure.
I'm well aware that there are people who really hate me, who don't just, you know, and I think hate is a really odd word, but I get, you know, people tell me that they hate me on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot. And it's a really odd thing, like nobody, it's, I don't think people are as mean about actors or musicians or painters. People don't ever go, oh my God, Jackson Pollock, I bloody hate him. They just would not bother going to see an exhibition. Or
I think it must be to do with the thing that you as a comic give to people, which is that you make them lose control of themselves. That currency is so precious and so valuable that if you offer it to someone and say, I'm a comedian, and then don't make them laugh, they hate you.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? They're
because
like, you've but you said you were going to be incredible.
Deliver.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of worse than just being a crap indie band, isn't it? It's like, you know.
Yeah, because it's a bit, it's less offensive to be a crap indie band,
yes,
maybe.
Yes. I think that's right. It feels to that person, it feels offensive. I mean, I'm guilty of that myself. There are comics, not ones that I know particularly, but there are comics out there who I really can't stand, who are just like, oh, it's, you know, you see someone, you might go, oh, this is cheap, it's awful, it's obvious, all those sort of things. And then you meet them maybe after a gig and you go, oh, no, you're just like me, you're just up there risking yourself.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, exactly.
But even then, if you watch, I watch people and go, it's not my cup of tea. But the audience are laughing. And you can't then deny, you can't say that somebody's not funny. You can just say that it's not your taste.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? So I can't remember what the question was. What were you talking about?
You were saying about...
About sometimes struggling.
Yes.
So sometimes if I come out at a new material night, it can go, it can be hard because there are people who... And I it's that thing of, do they really hate me or am I just looking and reading things into their faces? But I think... Maybe I am, but I think we all do that a little bit, that we look and go, oh, he doesn't like me. Or like, I heard from another comic where sometimes if people lean into each other while they're on, when chances are they're going, I'm going for a wee in the break, or they're going, do you want a gin and tonic?
Yeah.
That comic thought that they were saying, isn't he shit?
Yeah, of course.
And I think we all have a bit of that, where if somebody heckles, you immediately think they're going, you're shit, when really they're just going...
Yeah, exactly.
Did you cough there? Did you cough your shit?
Do you personally have any kind of strategies as to what to think in those situations? Like, because I imagine the way you seem to operate in the world when 7 years ago when we did So You Think You're Funny.
That was it was a good year. We were a good year. There's a lot of good people from that year.
A lot of good people. Joe Wilkinson and Kevin Bridges. And Kevin didn't place, did he?
No, because Joe was third, I was second.
And Tom Allen was first, but he was third because Julian Clary read the piece of paper upside down.
Yes, so I sort of felt like I won because I knew the best I could possibly do would be second.
Yeah,
The last one that was announced was second place.
Well, there we go. That's exactly my point. Because to come and say, well, I felt that like I'd won because I knew I was second. That's so typical of your mentality. I know a lot of the people that listen to this are newer comics. And recently I've had a couple of emails and conversations which have expressed the same thing, which is, it's all very well all these comedians saying, and then I turn pro. And they're all going, but how? How do you do that? So I'm trying to... I'm not asking you that question necessarily, but I think I'm trying to put more of a... Okay, then we'll start with that. How did you or how does one turn from being a... a comedian who's got a day job to being a comedian who can just do comedy?
Something that was said to me at the time, which I think is very true, is that there's never a comfortable time to make the leap. It's never, you've never got like money in the bank and going, I can pay 3 months of my bills with it. It's never comfortable. It's always a risk. But it sort of feels, there's a day when it feels right. Prior to that, in order to get to that point, you have to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to work incredibly hard. I worked at... I don't mean working hard like I know nurses and doctors and firemen work a lot harder than we do. I know that their job is harder. I'm not an idiot. But I do know that this is the hardest I've ever worked in my life. And sometimes... because it doesn't feel like work a lot of the time because I love my job. And that's why I'm not very good at taking time off. Because it's easy to take time off from a job where you clock in, you clock out, and you go, I'll get 2 weeks off every year. I'm going to go on holiday to Spain.
Sure.
But if you have a job that you love, it's hard to go, I still need a day off from it. Yeah. It's still, you know. But I used to, some of my peers, I think, were doing sort of one or two gigs a month. And I would do 3 or 4 a week.
Mm.
And because I got divorced and moved in with my parents when I started doing stand-up. So my outgoings were quite small, quite low. And I dropped down to 25 hours a week instead of 40 at work so that I could have a bit more flexibility. So my outgoings were like my board to my mum and dad and my phone bill.
Mm.
So I could spend the rest on train tickets and bus tickets and hotels, or more realistically staying on people's sofas and things in the beginning. Sometimes I was treating myself to a travel lodge if I didn't know anybody in that area, but I slept on so many sofas. So what I did with my diary as well is, if I did 3 gigs in a week, I put 3 gigs in a week. So if I looked at my diary and I had like 4 gigs to do that week, I would actively get, because when you're doing open spots, it's easy to get them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is. Maybe there's a lot more comics now than there used to be.
Is that what's coming up? Case, okay. Yeah.
Well, in my day, back in the day, when I was a child, it was quite easy because they don't have to pay you. They're happy to just, you know, pad the bill out with people who are learning the trade. So I could quite easily get 4 gigs put in my diary for further down the line. And I never had anything less than 50 gigs in my diary at any one time. Mm. That's how I worked it. And it really worked because I never look at, you know, I think people look at their diary sometimes and go, I've got nothing in. Mm. Never happened. Never had anything less than 50. Because if I did 3 that week, I booked through 3 in. But maybe there are more.
What do you mean? If you did 3 that week, you book 3 in. Like every time you did one, you'd book another one in for the end of the.
So I look at my diary and say, I've got 4 gigs in this week. I need to book 4 gigs in the future.
For the future,
So I would email 10 people and hopefully get 4 gigs or whatever off the back of that. And they could be 6 months down the line. It doesn't matter when they are. It means my diary still has 50 gigs in it, and your diary is never ending. So. That was the trick. I used to go into my day job an hour earlier than I needed to be there, and because I didn't have a computer. So I'd go in and I'd just do that kind of, you know, that morning pages that people talk about where they just like a stream of consciousness every morning. So I'd go in at 8, start at 9, didn't clock in till 9, but went in. I had an agreement with my boss that they said I could come in earlier. And sat at the computer and just wrote for an hour. And I've still got some of those, like, printed off. Printed off and deleted, obviously, off the system. Yeah. And then I would have a look. And still, some of my very early bankers came from me just rambling. Because I was going through a divorce. I was living back with my parents. There was a lot of stuff going on in my head. Sure. And it was quite a nice release to get it out of my system anyway. And then if a joke came off the back of it, then brilliant. So that was something that I did. But I just... I worked really, really hard. I think comedy throws off the people who, if it's like a book, somebody described it once to me like a book on Bronco, and it throws off the people that just don't put the work in.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the non-funny people. There are people working who aren't particularly funny, but work really hard and make a living off the back of it. And you know what? Power to them, because it's harder for them. So I think the way you become pro is by showing everybody what you can do, but in the process... learning how to do it. So you nobody's brilliant at the beginning. You might have a natural talent, but you don't know how to play every room, and I think that's part of the job. My second gig, my first one was pretty good, my second one rocked, but then probably third and fourth were and it's not about being it's partly about being funny, but it's partly about being able to work any room and being able to make your jokes work in any room. I remember when I did the new comedy awards for the BBC, Dara O'Brien was comparing, and he said, what's your like number one ambition? And I think some people in might say, I want to get out the telly, or I want to be an actress, or I want to tour, I want DVDs, and I said, I want to be able to play every room. I wanted to be able to go into a room with 4 people above a pub that has a pool table over there, none of them have paid, they don't really want you, and make them piss themselves. But equally be able to stand on a stage at Hammersmith Apollo and it's sold out and you make them piss themselves. I just want to be able to play any room, any hard rooms. I want to be able to do that. And I think I got to that point where arrogant to say that I can play every room, because I don't think I can, but because I think I came off the circuit as I was learning how to do the really hard ones.
Sure.
And I don't know, because I don't know if I'd be able to go into a hard room now, because they treat me differently. They're looking at me like, that's that woman off the telly. We love her, we hate her. Rather than, I don't get judged on my jokes anymore. I get judged on what their preconceived idea of me is. So sure. I don't know if I'd ever test that again. I don't think I can legitimately.
Sure.
Unless I changed my face. That might work.
So this is Sarah. Just a brief interruption before we get back to this Compendium episode. It's so long ago, and she was so, so brilliant even then. Of course, she's continuing to smash it ever since. We will talk a little further about treating yourself well, about offending a full room and why that's preferable to offending individuals. And we'll talk about getting prejudged as her off the telly. More from Sarah in just a second. Just a reminder, you can join the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. If you would like to support the show, get hold of ad-free episodes in your own private podcast feed, join a community which is effectively deep nerd. It's big nerd. So you can join that if you like. And also you will get... What else do you get? Private podcast, ad-free episodes. Oh, yeah, all the extras from all the episodes that had them. My word, there's a lot of them now. So go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to support the show and get all of that gubbins. Remember, stuartgoldsmith.com to find out more about I Need You Alive, my brand new comedy special produced by 800 Pound Gorilla and the first non-self-produced DIY special I have ever released. I'm super proud of it. I hope you will join me on the 23rd of February to enjoy that moment. Back to Sarah.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Do you sit down and write for a certain number of hours a week? Did you ever? Well, I mean, obviously, that's we sort of started to touch on that with that early morning thing, which I think is already a brilliant tip, because I certainly, when I had an office job for a very little while in my transitional phase, I would try and do the jokes after work. That's not going to work, is it? I never thought to go in earlier and get all that morning energy and all the rest of it.
It's the morningness, but also it's the fact that you can then sit at a job that you feel unused in. And And not that the people that I worked with weren't lovely and weren't great, to feel sort of frustrated and untapped and all of those things that a lot of people feel in a job. But knowing that you've just done an hour of writing, you can sit at a desk for 8 hours and answer phones or type or whatever you have to do, because you've potentially written a couple of jokes that when you get the metro to the Chillingham Arms, like I used to do in Newcastle, I did it. It was a new material night that Gavin Webster used to run, and I did it 7 weeks in a row, and that's how I got from my 10 to my 20. Okay. I did 7 minutes 7 weeks in a row, and I sometimes wrote it on the way in on the metro, and I tried it out, and generally it would start off with the 7 minutes. There'd be a minute of gold is cocky, a minute of good stuff that worked straight away. Then there might be 3 or 4 minutes of stuff that had potential but wasn't there yet, and then the rest is dirge. It got better over the years. Now I can write 20 minutes of new stuff and 15 will work, and it's just because of being better at ditching stuff early on. So I don't try the stuff that I think, like, I think I'm just better at knowing what works and better at knowing how I can tell a joke. But in the early days I'd go up and there'd be 1 minute, but if there's 1 minute out of seven, I'm really happy with that. That's great. So that's how I used to write. So I'd go into work early and I'd type and type and type, and then I'd happily sit for 7 or 8 hours while I did something that paid my train fares largely to Lincoln or wherever, random places. But now I'm not as good as I should be. I busk is not the right word. I do work really hard, but I tend to always be making notes. As soon as especially September is my, oh my God, I've got to write another show. I don't start it in March. I start it in September. I start making notes in September, but it's just constantly making little scribbly notes in notebooks and sending texts to myself. And sometimes if I say something funny, my boyfriend will text me the funny thing that I said. Because I think it's all about harnessing it, because it's quite easy to go, I'll write that down later on. And of course, what happens later on? It's gone. No matter how long you've been doing this, this still goes. I don't think I'm any better at retaining information now as I was then, so I still have to scribble it down.
One of the questions that someone tweeted was, if you think of an idea during sex, do you trust it to memory, or do you stop and then make a little note? You don't have to answer that, but I can see from your face what the answer is.
Depends which bit of the sex. I think it's totally fine to pause during foreplay.
Okay, good, good. There we go. That's an answer. That's
it is, but I think funny ideas don't happen during the main crux.
Yeah.
Because I'm not really thinking about funny thoughts. If I am, that's a bad relationship, isn't it? And I'm not. But if something occurs to me early doors, I will make a note of it. Maybe you could just, I don't know, this is, you might have to edit this out. Maybe you could just ask him. If you could just, it's all I want.
I thought you were going to say something like maybe you could just write it on his back.
No,
it was much worse than that.
Sorry. I'm quite rude. So I make notes constantly.
Yeah. And when you're making those notes, are you just...
Should I show you?
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant.
Let's have a look.
But are you turning them into jokes at that time, or is September just krill? Just get all the stuff?
Well, it's not even just September. It's pretty much 12 months of the year I make little notes. So I've got a little notebook here. And what they'll be is enough that will remind me of a story or an idea. So it might just be three words, but they won't necessarily, it won't be a sentence. It might just be three words, and those three words remind me of that thing that I said about the thing that actually made me laugh.
Because
it has to make me laugh, because if it doesn't make me laugh, I've got nowhere to go, you know.
Yeah. So can you give us an example?
Yes. I was talking to my mum on the phone. My mum and dad are on holiday, and I was talking to my mum on the phone, and you know how sometimes when you're on the phone to somebody, but there's somebody else in the room, you sometimes say things to them. So you'll sort of, say if I answered my phone now, I'll be talking to them. But then you might say, oh, can I get something out of the fridge? And I'll go, yeah, it's fine. But then I'm still talking to, I was talking to my mum, and my dad was in the background, and my mum just said, not with that hand, you won't. And I just have no idea why that made me laugh so much. I don't want to know what that's linked to, because my mind is already working overtime. So I don't know if that'll end up, but I've just written down, not with that hand, dash, mum.
Okay.
And that reminded me of that.
So let's follow that idea then. What do you do next to that bit? Do you sit and write around it? Do you just take it on stage and say it and improvise around it?
I think it was your Ben Norris podcast. I was very interested when you said, I think it was you that said it rather than Ben, that sometimes by sort of verbalising an idea, it's more funny things come out of telling somebody about it than writing it down.
Yeah,
you said that, didn't you?
I think so, yeah.
So if I write that down and try and write a joke around it, it's not as easy than if I just talk about it to somebody. Or I don't know, if maybe it doesn't even need the person. Maybe I just should do it in the flat on my own. But I tend to, that'll stay there until I've got a new material night. All that notes will stay. And then on the new material day, I will shit myself all day and write for like 2 hours. Literally pulling together all of these little bits and typing them all up and actually going, right, what we got, and not having any idea, still not, can't time it, still have no idea.
And will you be typing up just those three words, or will you be typing up the story out?
Well, typing up probably just what I often use is index cards, because the reason I use index cards is when I do new material, if it's on paper it rattles because I'm nervous.
Yeah, okay.
But if I use cardboard, it's like someday I'll use like wood. It gets gradually thicker. I'll just be there with a slate with my jokes on it. And I will probably write that, what I've written in my notepad, on the slate. On the slate.
Well, think of them as the slates from now on. It's Millikan's second law of slates.
On the index card. So I'll write that on the index card. And then I will leave a little gap, and then I'll write the next one, and then leave a little gap, and then I'll write the next one. And then while I'm backstage, I'll sort of try and add extra bits, extra more, like words that might spark off.
And do you feel that what that suggests to me, and this might be the thing that I'm putting on it, but I find the pressure of a gig, like the pressure of telling a human being, activates your mind in a different way. So you're actually coming up with more things and than you could do if you were just sat in your
flat. On my own, just typing. And I don't know if it's the better way of working, but it seems to be working. So, you know, it seems to work now. And what normally happens at a new material night is if I do what I think is the punchline and they don't laugh, I naturally improvise an alternative punchline.
Yeah.
Because I don't like that bit when they go, oh, that was it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't like that bit. So I have to make sure that I'm fully rested before I try new material. I have to make sure that I've eaten properly and I've drunk water and I've slept well. Because if I go up, I always do my first Edinburgh preview in February at the Leicester Comedy Festival because it makes me panic. Because it's February and I go, I've only got 20 minutes. And then I go, it's February, I've got 20 minutes. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So I do a full hour.
It's all mental games with yourself, isn't it?
To trick yourself into this is fine. So if I know exactly where I am in February. So I know either, oh God, I'm going to have to haul ass and get loads of work done. Or I'm actually, this is coming along at a nice pace. I did an Edinburgh preview in Leicester a couple of years ago when I had the most chronic toothache. I've never really been a big sufferer of toothache, but I had the most heroic toothache. I'd had some work done, and this is by the by. But basically, as I found out later on, I needed 3 lots of root canal while I was going through this pain.
Oh, my God.
And I was on a lot of painkillers and also this gel that you rub on your gums when you're teething. Right, this is... Okay. So I was rubbing it on and going on stage, sometimes in tears before the gig because it was so awful. And I had this new material night in the middle of it all. I remember booking myself into a hotel in Leicester. I only live in Manchester. That's a drive. That's an easy drive. I would never book myself in a hotel because I needed to get in and just calm down because I was in tense and in agony. And I remember being at 5 to 8. The gig was a 2-minute walk from there. At 5 to 8, I was still curled up in like the fetal position in this pain. Went along, did the gig. And every time I did a joke that didn't work and they went, no, I went, okay, number 4. Because I had nothing. Yeah. I had nothing else. There was no spark.
You weren't overreaching.
And this is where I have to make sure that I'm well rested and I've slept and I'm, you know, and I've eaten properly and I've looked after myself, because that's when I'm funny. It's like whenever I do a TV thing, if it's a case of I've got 5 hours to do prep for this, do I do 5 hours or do I do 4 hours and have an extra hour's sleep? It's always the extra hour's sleep, because I will be, a lot of the stuff that I'll see in a panel show is off the cuff and off banter off other people and what they've said. And I have to be fully rested in order for that part of my brain to kick in.
Sure.
So I could do 5 hours of prep for a panel show or 3 hours and have an extra 2 hours sleep. And that's much more beneficial because I won't have as much stuff on paper, but I'll have a better functioning brain.
Yes. Okay.
So that's when I do. So it'll go. So then I record. Always record my new material nights. Always record them.
Yeah.
And
you always listen to the recordings?
Not always.
No. Okay.
when you do 28 previews and sometimes it's 4 in a week, it's hard to listen to another hour because you can't listen while you're driving because you've got to make notes of it. But what I often do as well is recording it. Is you're recording it really in case anything amazing happened that you can't remember. But often if you make notes as soon as you come off, then. You get most of it down, and I sometimes make notes as I go, which is really rude, but if they know it's a new material night and they're not paying anything to say anybody, then they don't mind, and I'll just make, and it might just be one word where I've thought of an extra top row or whatever, but I do sometimes listen, especially if it's 10 minutes, if it's 10 minute new material night, I'll listen to that easy, but if it's an hour, sometimes it's hard to fit it in, and then it's very rare that my jokes get typed up in full now, because then that goes into an hour show or a 2 hour show or whatever, an hour and a half show. And it'll still just be, that'll still be hand mam, that'll be known as my big full list of jokes. So I sort of kind of write on stage now compared to I used to write and fully form a joke and it would be word for word and then I would read it off and then it would work or it wouldn't work. And I kind of go on with a rough idea of what it is.
Yeah.
And by describing it and talking around it, around an idea, I usually get 5 or 6 more punchlines off the back of it. And it's really effective. But I think that's just because I'm better on stage than I used to be. I think, because I always think that's... Well, all comics can be divided into writers who perform or performers who write.
Mm-hmm.
I was always a writer who performed. I think there's only... I was going to say Kitson, but Kitson's still a writer who performs.
Mm-hmm.
I think all... comics can divided it. So it was always the performance that was always the hard thing that I had to bring up to the level of my writing, because I'd been writing since I was 17 in one kind or another, local newspaper columns or short films or whatever. So, and then I think the people who are amazingly funny performers need to crack on with their writing to bring that up to the level of their performance. So I've never really worried about my writing so much as my performance. The writing's always, it's not come naturally, it sounds really cocky to say that, but it is something I find easier than standing on a stage is always the bit that makes me slightly uncomfortable.
Okay.
Is that weird?
Yes. No, not at all. I think that's probably very true. about the different types of performer there are. I mean, rather like in my first show with Rob Deering, the first interview I did, when he was talking about, you know, he said, in a week I normally won't do any writing. I won't sit down and do any writing. Yep. And I started imagining this kind of halcyon future of going, oh, imagine I wouldn't stress out during the day. And I would, like, I love writing, but I spend most of my day putting off writing. And that makes me anxious and unhappy. So it makes me feel like what you do is... You might not get up and write for your stand-up in the day, but if you've done the rest of the work at the other times, you've done all of the note-taking, you've done all of the thinking about the notes, you've done all of the prep on the way to the gig, you've done the gig as often as possible, and you do the work after the gig making the notes, I kind of find that I get stressed during the day, I eventually do the writing, and then I go to the gig, I do the stuff, it works or it doesn't, and then I go, oh, I've been working all day, I'll relax now.
Yes, I'm sort of always slightly writing. If that makes sense. Because if anything funny happens, or if I see anything funny, or if I have a funny idea, or if I read a bit in a newspaper and I think, oh, that could make that work into a joke or whatever, I make a little note of it. So it's always constantly there, but I very rarely... It's only if I'm writing a script, and that is when I'm an absolute bitch. I am such a horrible person when I'm writing a script. I get tense, I cry, I scream. I'm a horrible, horrible person.
And that's because you're faced with the tyranny of the blank page and having to fill it, and so all of your systems are out the window because you just must minute. Do it.
Yeah. I've written scripts that... have to be performed the next day for a recording. I've written them that day for the next day. I've stayed up. I went through some horrible times on the first tour when I did a gig in Norwich. No, I did a gig in Aberdeen. I flew from Aberdeen to Norwich to do Frank Skinner's Opinionated. And then I stayed up all night. And then got to write my script. Got a train to London to record the script. I have not gone to bed. Got a train to London. Vomited on the train. And the BBC, my producer said, we'll get you somewhere that we can have a lie down. So I had a lie down for an hour. And then I did the recording. And I never want to... So when I'm on tour, I try not to have any writing projects hanging over me, because that is horrific. To be doing a tour show, then... flying, then and not getting much sleep that night, flying and then writing all day and then doing a TV record and I did everything to the best as I possibly could for where I was at. That's why I don't like taking writing projects on, because I know what I get like, and I know it's better if I just go, right, we're going to write for a month and that's all we're going to do. We're not going to do any shows in the evening. We're just going to write for the month, because it's too... I find writing much more stressful than performing. I actually feel my stomach knotting at the thought of having to sit down and write.
Yes. So do you think now you're a performer who writes? It's kind of shifted because now you're that comfortable on stage.
I still write, but I just scribble constantly.
Yeah.
And I think I find it much easier. It means when it comes to like February to do like the Leicester Comedy Festival, I quite easily have an hour. It's not an hour of good stuff, but it's an hour of stuff.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like I have this romantic idea. I think it's because I used to write plays and I wanted to be a film director and I wanted to write film scripts. I have this romantic idea of sitting in cafes and writing. I have a few friends who do that and I'm very jealous of them. And I think I need to find a cafe that I can sit and write and just have like tea and milkshakes and things. But I don't know how much work you get done there.
Yes, Adam says you have to cafe hop. So you have to go from one to another, to another, to another, to another. So you're always in a new place with new stimulation.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. But that's something I want to do over the next few months when my diary's not as busy, is sit in cafes and write. Because it's this romantic idea of that's where ideas come from. When they don't, my ideas come from me living a bit of a normal life and seeing my friends.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the only funny ideas I have are, related to dressing rooms.
this is a common problem, isn't it?
I believe in staying in nice hotels when you can afford it, and I can afford it. I've worked really hard. I've stayed on many a sofa, I've stayed in many a travel lodge, and now I can afford a nice hotel, and I think it's more important to treat yourself really well and to make sure that you've slept well and you do a good job, because potentially 2,000 people have paid £20 a year ago. I can't be shit tonight.
Yes.
So I make sure that I sleep well, and that I have a tour manager now, which I only had for the second half of the first tour, so I don't do any driving. And it's hard because you're away from home for long periods of time, and it's hard in that you never really settle anywhere, you never really unpack. But it's not, it's much easier than it was when I was doing driving for 6 hours, doing a 2 hour show and then driving for 6 hours.
Sure.
It's much easier than that. And I'm very lucky to be able to afford all of that sort of thing. But I kind of miss the, oh, I'm stuck somewhere for 6 hours, I go and sit in a cafe and write. Because yes. I'm never stuck anywhere now.
No,
and I sort of miss that. Do you know what I mean? I miss the romantic idea of what a writer is. Probably more what a poet is. I don't want to be a poet. But do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that idea of that, I can't afford my heating, so I'll go and sit in a cafe.
Yes.
You know, where realistically, I can sit in my flat and write here just as well. But I want to sit in a cafe and write. It's ridiculous.
Talking about the way you write, the system for putting things in the notebook and then getting them onto the page, it seems like a kind of a reactive system. Things happen, you make a note.
Do you
ever try, and I know you don't write theme shows anymore, but do you ever pick a subject and go, right, I'm going to do that?
No, and I want to. I really want to, because the last two shows I've done by just gathering. So it's gathering. Yes. If I say something funny, or I say something funny, or I say something to somebody, one of my friends, and they say something funny, and then we have a bit of banter. And it's good if your friends aren't comedians, because then you can go, can I have that? Where if they're comedians, we have to tussle. And if I have conversations with my family, are generally hilarious. So that works. Or if funny things happen to me, or I think of funny things. But generally, I don't sit down and go, I'm going to write some stuff about dogs. I don't know if I can do that. I must be able to, because when I do panel shows, or when I do... when we did the TV series, you're writing to a subject, which I'd never done before. Mm. I'd never written to a subject. And I found it quite a good... It's quite stimulating, but also quite a good sort of pressure to put yourself under, to go, I have to write some jokes about costume drama or whatever. Mm-hmm. Where normally I just go, oh, that's a funny thing that my dad said, I'll say that. And that,
sure.
You know, and I'll write around it and I'll funny him up, although he is normally really funny, but sometimes he goes, I was really funny in that thing, and you think, I did tweak it, Dad.
I did put 8 tags on top of it.
I did some work.
Yeah.
But I really want to sit down and have an idea rather than a joke. I've always got a punchline and I work around the punchline. But what I'd like to do is go, I'd like to write some stuff about the fact that... for example, I don't want children. I've written some stuff about that, but maybe the fact that because I think it's one of the final taboos to stand on stage as a woman in her 30s and say I don't want children. So not that I can't have them, but that I don't want them. I think you can get away with jokes about anything as long as you're coming at it from the right angle. So you don't write misogynistic or racist or homophobic jokes, but you can write jokes about those things.
Yes.
That as long as they're coming in from a good angle, from a good, as in good as in, I don't mean good as in not... not a bad joke. I mean, good as in wholesome.
Yes,
in a way.
Yes,
you can honest and from the viewpoint of a nice person, I suppose, an honourable person. You can write jokes about anything, but I think still, when I say on stage, somebody, I said, I don't want kids. I don't really like kids, and somebody booed in a tour show. Man, but it's quite the confidence of a man who boos, assuming that everybody's going to follow suit and they all don't, is quite funny in itself. a boo on its own isn't scary, but it did make me think I wasn't going to do some slightly harsher stuff about kids, and I thought, well, you've just made me want to do that.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
So I brought out all the big guns.
You know, people will be strategically booing now. Whatever you do something a bit edgy, let's get it fired up. Yeah.
It really does. Because as soon as somebody says, I don't think you're right, like, there's something wrong with me because I don't want kids, that makes me go, all right, okay. Well, it's, you know, because there's a lot of people who think like me. So I need to write more to order a little bit. And I need to sit down a bit more and write a bit more. And I need to do it in cafes.
Yeah, that's a good plan. That's why
because I like eating. So why not kill two birds with one stone?
Which circuit comics, when you were still on the circuit, inspired you? Which people did you see and think? Of course, the question I'd really like to ask is, which ones did you hate? But that's another time.
I'll do that in the car.
But which ones did you inspired you in terms of either their work ethic or their approach to the gig or the stuff they were doing or their courage or something?
I like to watch comics who could play a hard room without any tricks. Now, we all have sort of bankers and whatnot, but some weekend clubs employ people who are not just straight stand-ups. So they are funny and they work very hard, but they might also do music, or they might have a CD backing track where they do a bit of funny stuff to it. And they're often quite crowd-pleasing stuff that are massively effective. And you can't blame them at all because they work brilliantly in those rooms. Or some people do sort of magic-y stuff, and and everywhere has its place. But I am impressed by those who just used words, who could control a room that I would look and go, this is going to be really hard. And thank God I'm only opening a Midland, because by the time the closer goes on, they're going to be shit-faced. And they would just use words. And I was always impressed by the bottle of those people. Sean Collins, for example, I saw close a really rowdy jungler sitting on a fucking stool. What was that?
Yeah.
The confidence of the man.
Isn't it great?
And it's slow. I love his accent. He's got a lovely, slow, sort of laconic delivery and had them in the palm of his hand. And it was really impressive. I did a whole week of Edinburgh weekend clubs at Christmas, like the sort of rowdy Christmas gigs. And you know, the Christmas is a horrible time for comedians because it's all Christmas parties where two of them have gone, let's go to comedy, and the other 88 have been dragged along. And I've seen people get, bread rolls thrown at them. Jesus. It's when you come out and you see they've all got the party hats on and they've all got those party things that curl up the end, what they're called, and you think, oh, this is going to be horrible. And then somebody comes in and says, everybody just do 15s, and you all go, yay. I once instigated that. I once said to the show manager, that's looking, we're starting late, it's looking rowdy, I guess you want us just to do 15s. And it was quite a new show manager who went, good idea. And as he left, all the other comics high-fived me. You're welcome. And Craig Campbell was closing all week, and there was actually the hardest night. He didn't have anywhere near as hard a time as the rest of us, because I would say 2/3 to 3/4 of the audience were from one company, and they were rowdy and weren't listening, and they were a horrible audience. And the security staff couldn't, there were too many for the security staff to get rid of them all. So what they did was they waited until anybody went to the loo, and they just didn't let them back in.
Oh,
so,
very good.
And because they were drinking,
I thought this story was going to end with, and what Craig Campbell was doing is he's a one man security team.
Two blokes or women would go to the loo hammered because they were drinking so much. They were going to the loo quite a lot, and they just kicked them out. So gradually, by the time Craig went on, actually on this particular night, there was a third of the room full, but of lovely people who wanted to come to the comedy. So on that night, he had a nice time. But the rest of the week, because I remember that night, Simon Bly was in the middle and I was opening, and he came over to me in an adorable sort of fatherly kind of way, even though there's probably only 10 years between us, and said, do you want me to go on first? And I said, I just want to get the fucker out of the way. Because I thought, this isn't going to get better as the night goes on. I'm going to have this probably the easiest job. And it was, as it turns out, they'd all gone by the time the break was. So Craig Campbell had the easiest. But Craig, for the whole week, with nothing but words, just was amazing at Christmas gigs, at horrible, horrible Christmas gigs where they're talking and they're eating and they don't really want you to be there.
And do you remember what it was? What aspect that it was? I mean, I know he's doing a million different things at once, but what do you think it was that made that
experience
work so much?
Experience and knowing which joke you start on to make them go, oh, rather than make them go, oh, I think it's just experience. It's just, he probably didn't enjoy it any more than I enjoyed mine, because he was foot on the gas probably all the way through. Sure. You can't leave a gap because that's when somebody pops up their head up. I always think they're a little bit like the meerkats, because they just pop their head up. I did one once where, it was one of those gigs where you think, if I trip over a word at any point during this, that somebody's, they're going to fucking
gonna
have me.
Eat you alive, yeah.
And as I was busy thinking that, I tripped over a word.
Yeah.
Concentrate on the job in hand, Milliken. And I tripped over a word, and all I said was, oh, that'll be all those cocks I've been sucking. And everybody went, and back down again. Thank God for that. So, who else? Gavin Webster, I think, is very good.
Yeah.
I think it was all the headliners while I was doing supports and opening and middle and all of the headliners, because you look and you go, I'll never be as good as that. I remember doing, I died once at, this has just become a podcast all about my deaths, but I died once at Leicester, a gig in Leicester, when I was opening, Tom Stead was in the middle and Jim Jefferies was closing.
Wow.
I died. Tom Stead struggled for his first 10 to 12 minutes and then got them, and then they were okay for him. And you know how good Tom Stead is. He's awesome. And then Jim Jefferies properly won them over, and it was a real... There was one woman in the audience who had decided she wasn't going to like him, and he... It didn't bully her at all, but just was determined. You could see he was determined to make her laugh, and by the end she was pissing herself. And it was just a really skillful job that he did, and I liked watching people. Nailing an easy room is, you sort of come off and go, brilliant, that was great, I feel great, I'm funny, hooray, I'm good at my job. But nailing it, turning a room around from they hate me, or they're not listening, or, you know, to this is now a playable room. Like, sometimes, you know, you go on first, or maybe because I don't really compete, but, you know, when you compete, you go on, and you make it a playable room from an unplayable room. And that feels like you've really done a good job. Mm. You've worked your arse off and you've made it a playable room for the rest of the night. I think that's one of the skills.
What kind of comic did you think you'd be when you started out? Have you turned into the sort of comic you anticipated being? Because I think you've... Well, I won't say what I think. I'll let you answer that question.
I think I've softened. I was... harsher in the beginning. My first gig that I ever did ended with a joke that I wouldn't do now. Couldn't get away with it now.
Can you tell us what the joke was?
No.
Can you?
Possibly tell you the joke. It was very harsh. And
I think I remember it. I remember the existence of a harsh joke, but I can't remember the
word. There was a few.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have become a comic that is just a bit more accessible and a bit more public friendly because I wanted to be that, or because I've just aged and have realised that you can... I don't mind offending a whole room, but I don't want to offend one person. So if I do a joke about something mean about kids, and there's somebody in the audience who's lost a child, I would be mortified that thought that I had offended them. But I'll quite easily do a joke that makes something about spunk or something. It makes the whole room go, probably just said that. Happy to do that.
Yeah.
But for one person to feel horrible in that room is not my job. Mm. Everybody should feel nice. So I think I've got older, and maybe that's why I'm not as... I've got a bit of an edge. I can still, like, I quite liked on the series when I was interviewing, I quite liked being a little bit mean to the guests because it was always in a cheeky way, but I could be quite sort of sharp and sort of bitchy is not the right word, but a little bit catty maybe. And because I'm a nice person, and because I think they knew that it was coming from a nice place, they all sort of, and also we always had guests on who were willing to go along with the ride and knew that it was a comedy show, it's not a chat show. But I think I've become the comic that I don't know what I wanted to be. I think I just wanted to be, I wanted it to be my job. So I guess I have become the comic because it is my job, but I'm not as edgy as I used to be. I was never really that edgy, but I did have a bit of a sharpness about me, and I don't think that's there anymore. And I think that's been an organic change, I think. The same as how some people start off one way and gradually fall into whatever they end up being. I think you find out who you are by doing it a lot. But I think when you play to so many people, be it on a telly where there's millions watching, or be it with an audience with a few thousand, I don't want anybody to go away feeling like they've been attacked. And I think if you do a joke... I don't know, because in one of a couple of shows ago, I had a rape joke that was right in the middle of the show, but it's about the angle that you come in at, and it was actually quite a soft angle. It was quite a feminist angle, and nobody batted an eyelid. I never got a complaint. I never got a message from anybody. So that trick is, if you're going to have a terrible, horrific joke, put it in the middle, because you can back it up by another joke straight away.
Tuck it between two stuff about cakes.
Because if you finish on it, people might leave going, oh, well, I liked the first 55 minutes, but that last one, and it colours their whole perception of what the show has been like.
But they can't walk out whistling a rape joke, can they? No.
But you see, the thing is about the cakes thing, I've written like four jokes ever about cake, but because they were the ones that were on the telly, you know, and you know, people do that. If you could write a letter to your 12-year-old self, what you'd write, and some people would say, don't fall in love with that man, or work harder at school. I would say, you're going to be a comic, don't write any jokes about fucking cake.
Because I saw you flinch when I mentioned that, and I'm afraid it's just because I received 30 tweets today about cake.
Yeah.
But in the same way that Joe Brand was pilloried for jokes about periods and tampons,
people pick up on one thing. Yeah.
Which reminds me, I always used to call you Periods Milliken to wake you up.
Periods Milliken. Because I did so many jokes about periods. Because
you did so many jokes, yeah.
Somebody once collared me and said, I have a period joke. And I said, I don't have any period jokes. Yeah. And he said, oh, you know what you did? And I went, you get me mixed up with somebody else. You just, because I'm a woman, he went, oh, she's probably got period jokes. Periods aren't funny. That's why I'm going to period jokes. So I don't... I'd like to think that I've just evolved into the comic that I am because I've aged and I just don't want to offend anybody. But maybe I've softened. It's one or the other. It's either that or I've softened because of the way that sort of a mass audience makes you behave that way. Because I don't want everybody to like me. I wouldn't stop being rude, for example. Sure. You can't be as rude on the telly, but I'm a little bit rude on the telly, but I wouldn't stop because I don't, you know, because, 5-year-olds have to be my fans. No. I'm not bothered about 5-year-olds being my fans. It's comedy, it's for adults, so I'm not really bothered.
The last thing I was going to ask was, if the old plan was to be able to play any room in the country, if that was the goal that you started with, and you said to a certain extent you went some way towards completing that, or maybe superseded that being a necessary part of the plan, what's the new plan at the moment, now that you are a lady who has fingers in many pies, who has all sorts of TV and writing and radio and touring opportunities? You strike me as the sort of person who will somewhere have a mission statement either written down or at the back of your mind. What do you want to do?
I think it's less a sort of 5-year plan of I want to be on series 6 by then, or, you know, I want to always be good. Because somebody said to me, who shall definitely remain nameless, that...
Until after I turn this machine off.
When you're successful, you doesn't have to be as good, because they come anyway.
Yeah.
But they might come to this one, but then they might not come to the one after that if this one is shit.
Yeah.
So... I want to always be good, because I think just because you're popular doesn't mean you can't be good. Popular is not the same as good.
Yes, popularity isn't the goal, is it?
No, popularity gets them in the door. Yeah. Popularity gets them in the door. Quality makes them come back again.
Mm.
And because you go into bigger and bigger rooms each time, or you do more and more nights maybe each time, because I don't really fancy arenas. Suits some people, but I don't think it suits me. So this is about working out how many nights we go on tour, and maybe that... it gets extended with each tour or whatever. So what you need is the people that came to come back and more each time. So therefore, I can't ever do a show that's not... It's still only my opinion if it's good or not. But I can't ever do a show that I'm not really proud of, because that might be the beginning of the end. So if everything that I do is as good as it can possibly be it TV, be it... you know, things I do for free that are just for fun, or, you know, that are things that sort of use my brain a little bit more, or TV spots on different things. I want everything to be as good as it can possibly be, and I don't want to ever think that I can slacken off, because I think now is the time that you must continue. And if you slacken off, I don't think you deserve it.
That was my start rumbling then.
For the rest of the banana. Like, your stomach disapproved of what I was saying.
Yeah, not... So do you want to still be touring? Do you want to be going out and driving 4 hours to a gig? Well, even if you can stay in a nice hotel now. But do you want to still be out and touring every night? And
not every night. At the moment, I've decided... because I did two tours like a year after each other. And I've decided to do every other year now. Because with Edinburgh and previews... because I do like 20 or 30 previews... it means that I'm on the road 10 months of the year, and I am 36 and do not own a plant.
Mm.
And I'd quite like to have a bit more of roots, I guess. And maybe a pet and maybe a plant and maybe a big milk in my fridge every now and again rather than a one pinter.
Oh,
at the end of the tour, that's the first thing I do is I buy like a four pinter. I never drink it all because I don't really like milk. I just have it on me frosties and in me tea. I can't drink a glass. Oh, but it's a symbol of the end of a tour is buying a really big milk.
Yeah, I'm going to be home for a bit.
If every other year I tour, so I'm not touring. I've got 12 more dates at the end of this year, of this tour. And then I'll not be touring again until I'm going to do the Edinburgh Festival next year. So it means I have between now and then to do, we're doing another series of the TV programme and to maybe go to Australia or, you know, maybe just bits and bobs that are fun and nice to do and a little bit more living at home and... I've got a column in a magazine coming up, which I can't tell you what it is yet, but maybe by the time this goes out, I might be able to tell you. So that sort of thing. I'm trying to sort of give myself a bit of work that's in a flat that I can do and still earn money, because I know there'll be a time when nobody wants me anymore. When you, there'll be, it's the make hay while the sun shines. While people still find you funny and still, there'll be a time when they go, oh, it's just, you know, maybe the industry will change or people's people's taste will change, and I'm
just sick of the cake jokes. Endless cake jokes.
This is a fifth show about fucking cakes. So then I still want to have a job, so that's why I write things, and I quite like writing things that I'm not in. I like writing things and sending them off, and somebody else produces them and makes them, and they, you know, like radio stuff and columns and things that I can do and will hopefully still be able to continue while my face is. Nobody wants to see my face anymore, and that's not. I don't think it's defeatist. I think it's realistic that I'm not going to be. There's only Joan Rivers and Ken Dodd who are still doing it in their 70s and 80s. Nobody else is still doing it. So the chances of me being one of the two in that time is slim to none. So
I don't know. With your views on the trunk, I can see you trundling on stage up the creek in Deptford when you're 75. Calling them all pricks.
Well, I mean, but there might be, it might be that I decide I don't want to do On the Road anymore and maybe I want to do other things instead. But so if the way I'm lengthening my touring time is by doing it every other year, because I think if I did it every year, I might only do a few more and then go, oh God, I can't do it anymore. Sure. Wait, if I do it every other year, I get a year where I, and plus it makes the shows better because the shows are a year and a half in the making instead of being slightly shoved out, which they sometimes are. And it means the show can be really, really good. And that is worthy of people's ticket price. You know, I think it's, I can't really control ticket prices of things very much, but I can control the quality and length of the show. Mm. So the same with the DVD, the first DVD, I couldn't really control how much, because all of the shops charge whatever they want, but I can control the extras and how long the show is. And, you know, so you can control the product, if not necessarily how much people are paying for it. So you can make sure that it's worth the money that you know somebody's going to charge for it. So I think the ultimate goal is just to always be good no matter what you do, to make sure that you don't let the quality control slip. We did 111 dates on this tour, and in my month break, I made a 6-part TV series.
Oh my God.
And that's why I'm having this month off, because I'm fucked. But it's lovely just seeing friends, and I guess I'm having, you know how a lot of people have 2 days off a week? Just having them all in a month.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.